Ars Electronica 2009 Human Nature Podcast.
Go over to the next project because we have two awards of distinction. And the first one, of course, as maybe we ask this question of art and life, relations between art and life here socially and politically, we can also think about this biologically, physically, at whatever term. And this is what the second project was about. This was a project called Earthstar, and Earthstar is being shown here at Ars Electronica, at the OK Center, David Haynes and Joyce Hinterding, and embracing the growing fields of citizen science and amateur research, Earthstar is a poetically charged physical experience that emphasizes the sun's fundamental energies and hidden frequencies. So highlighting this project, the fascination grounded by, the fascination by Earth's center star throughout most cultures, human history, this time's Lee Gallery installation allows the audience to see, hear, and smell our life-giving cosmological neighbor. So thanks for welcoming David Haynes and Joyce Hinterding from Australia.
Thank you. It's certainly a testimony to the festival that even in this forum we will be travelling to another space altogether. And it's also a good opportunity to thank the festival for awarding us the Award of Distinction and giving us a chance to talk today. Our work takes many forms, but this is our work of the sky and the earth. We are often out in the landscape. We live in the Blue Mountains in Australia. It's a 30 million hectare World Heritage National Park that we're lucky to live in a small part that allows quite limited urban development to take place. Earthstar is a work about ionization. We are seeing the effects of it in the image. We are hearing it in the VLF antenna that's in the centre of the work, and we are imagining what it smells like with the fragrance compositions. The work explores frequency and resonance through its components. I'll just try and we'll just sort of run through what's actually happening in the work. The H-alpha image sequence of the sun's eruptions that we image with the H-alpha telescope shows the ionization of hydrogen within the sun. These images were photographed at various exposure levels to make moving image sequences that were either imaged in our backyard in the Blue Mountains where we live or in the outback of Western Australia when we were on a residency there last year. And also in that residency, we built a couple of Cloudbusters rainmaking machines based on Wilhelm Reich's principles that he had of organ in the 1960s. And this one, interestingly, made the front page of the West Australian newspaper with Sex Brings Rain to Farmers. And quite an extensive and reasonably rigorous article, I have to say, on some level. Okay, so I think we've got some video now. This is actually where the residency was. We were out working in this environment and thinking about working with the orgone devices and also we started to do the imaging work with the hydrogen alpha telescopes. Not much sun in the sky that day.
Has sound?
Yeah, I can just hear the sound, but I think it needs to somehow go louder. So the H-alpha telescope lets you look safely directly into the sun. And what we're seeing here is the activity around the chromosphere and then also a second exposure of the main mass.
And the sound that we're hearing here is from the, this is the VLF part of the radio spectrum, the very low frequency part of the radio spectrum. This is the antennas outside, away from the electromagnetic fields of buildings and man-made. And what you hear characteristically are these spherics sound. We decided, I've been mucking around and working with very low frequency antennas since about 1991. And fundamentally what happens with the VLF is that we're listening to the very low frequency part of the radio spectrum and the ionosphere. And the ionosphere is charged basically by the sun. So we're in part listening to the effect of the sun on our atmosphere. So I'll just, in the EarthStar work, we've decided to put two custom-built VLF antenna, which are 1 kilometre long each, and they're sitting inside the building. And when you experience the work, you'll realise that there's a lot of other sounds in there. There's not just that sound, characteristic sound of the ionosphere. There's also hissing and, sorry, that did that by itself. There's also a lot of hissing. What we're looking at here is the is a basic kind of breakdown of the frequency range, and you can see that the VLF part of the radio spectrum correlates directly to the audio hearing range, and so it allows the antenna to be plugged directly into the microphone or just basically into amplification systems. So the system is incredibly live. It also picks up a lot of the building ambient electromagnetic environment, and in the building that it's in at the moment, it's picking up a very beautiful hissing sound. The innovation in this work for me with the antenna is that I'm using a very narrow frequency band, and we'll talk a little further about that as we talk about the Hydrogen Alpha telescope and this way of looking into the sun. So my own work with the antenna, just to sort of give you a little background on where this antenna sort of comes from, this is a project called Aerology, and this has been going on for about 10 years. This is a 20-kilometre antenna, and this is really picking up electromagnetic activity out of the atmosphere, and it generates enough energy to drive the speakers without amplification equipment. And so this research has kind of taken me into looking at RFID and alternative energy systems coming out of the atmosphere, as well as a lot of the graphic antennas. This is a kind of more recent explorations of it. These are drawings with graphite of antennas that are all fully functioning, and they're functioning VLFs. And they're also also starting to use them as power sources. But just to kind of give you a little further background, this is a work that uses broadcast energy, the VHF, the disappearing VHF part of the analog broadcast signal. Again, these antennas are a kind of sculptural element, yet they're providing the soundtrack. Here we're listening to the carrier wave, the amount of energy that's actually pushing images across the globe. This is a work called Purple Rain, and it was exhibited in Sao Paulo Biennale and also probably quite a number of other countries in Europe.
It also the actual energy in the room also determines the outcome of the video piece as well. So it sort of seemed interesting to set up a scenario with the video piece, which is synthetically generated, and then allow the various fluctuations of the energy, the energy that's existing in the room, to determine the outcome of the work. And it was sort of an interesting point to let ourselves sort of step outside of the editing process and just let the forces, the invisible forces, determine the work.
So after looking at the frequency range that we're listening to, as David said, the work explores a kind of frequency, or it's looking through frequency, or listening through frequency, or various experiences of frequency. And this is an illustration of the Hydrogen Alpha telescope. And
it's a little bit technical, but how H-alpha works. It's a specific emission line created by hydrogen. And it has a wavelength of 656.28 nanometers, which is about half of 10 millionth of a millimeter, I think. So it's a very thin slither of the spectrum that we're actually looking at through the optics of the telescope. But it shows the visible part, the red part of the electromagnetic spectrum. It's the easiest way for astronomers to trace the ionized hydrogen content of gas clouds. Another application is to use H-alpha to look at nebula. The hydrogen alpha filter is an optical filter with a wavelength-dependent power transmission. It consists of a sequence of bifringent crystalline quartz plates, calcite, and polarizers that float in a gel. And that sort of stack diagram on the left-hand side shows you a fairly typical kind of arrangement of polarizing filters, calcite, quartz, etc., to build the actual stack of optics. But H-alpha is a form of light, and the H-alpha line occurs when hydrogen is being ionized, and of course that's exactly what's happening with the sun. There's lots of other things happening in the sun, but that's the one that's very interesting to look at. The aroma compositions use specific molecules from the fragrance industry, and the formula of the two fragrances were composed in our laboratory studio. Learning how to do this has been an important thing for me. As one facet of my artistic practice, and it's also the subject of my doctoral thesis, this notion of smell being an underutilized sensation in art, and the potentials and implications of that. We wanted to try to create smells that have an ozonic quality, taking two forms, one as given off by the ionization of excited molecules that at times resembles fresh air, and the other, which is of the earth, of the bushfire or the wildfire, which is often the result of lightning strikes. Sometimes fires start for other reasons. But all of these things that we're trying to imagine and have some kind of experience of have been affected in some way by the process of the sun's effect on the earth. The aroma functions a bit like a drawing of a tree in the work, rather than presenting the actual tree, because if you shove ozone up your nose, it's poisonous. However, there are a large class of safe smelly molecules that are described in the taxonomy of aroma molecules as being ozonic. I've made a few other kinds of aroma works. We just did a work last year where fragrances were commissioned around the smell of a river environment, one half of the river being salt water and the other part being highly polluted freshwater environment, the smell of an oil refinery, and seawater and rubber, a rubber tire plant featured in that particular fragrance. And I have also been reverse engineering some of the famous brand name fragrances from hacker formulas that come from the underworld of fragrance counterfeiting and cheap knockoffs. And I've been doing this largely as a learning exercise for me, but it's also spawned another work, the Fahrenheit Variations, which were recently exhibited in Melbourne. And they were compositions that were loosely based on John Louis Cerciac's masterpiece of 1988, Fahrenheit, which is still marketed and sold by Dior. Running a bit fast there with the images.
Sorry, I thought go forward. This is the Russian.
Yeah, this is the formula. Yeah, this is the classic Chanel 5 formula from a Russian part of the fragrance world, interestingly written in German, but it sort of might give you an idea of the complexity and the number of chemicals that are in a typical piece of perfume, let alone how an artist might actually work with this. And a lot of people also traditionally think of Chanel 5 as being this gorgeous natural thing. But in fact, Chanel 5's quality, as some of you may know, comes from its use of particular aldehydes, in fact, an overdose of aldehydes, which really brought the synthetic era of fragrance to the foreground. Fragrance has been largely synthetic since the 1800s. We include some drawings of some of the molecules. Indole is a material that's used in a lot of fragrance composition, and it's an interesting one because it's very close to serotonin and is also the central ring of LSD. we don't have time to sort of speculate on the active nature of some of these things. But indole is, very much in the smell of your shit, but it's essential if you're trying to simulate a beautiful smelling flower. The Kolonay molecule, which some of you might know from Issey Miyake, when they initially discovered this, they thought they'd found a tranquilizer, a Valium molecule. And then over on the right, we have a very interesting maritimer molecule, which is a nitrile molecule, which is sort of quite unusual in fragrance because normally they're the things which smell fishy. But in this case, this is an IFF molecule. In this case, we get very much a wet, fresh air tone. So I've started to sort of think about how we might be able to put some of these things together and add smell as a sensation into the work. Okay. Oh, a synthetic rose, just for curiosity's sake. That's a very simple one. Okay.
I guess there's the point of the ozone.
So at that point, I think we'll just quickly blast through some of our other works. But I'd just like to leave with one other thought about Earth Star, which is something which struck us in the course of making the work. The H-alpha optics turn out to be a type of resonating chamber, as the elements are tuned from the red wing to the blue wing. The antennas reveal resonance in the wire from the energy of the electrons in the air, and according to a theory of the olfactory that seems more and more likely based on the current state of research, what may be happening with smell is a biological tuning in the nose, a kind of spectrometer that is actually detecting the molecular frequency of the molecule as it spins. In a world that is literally an image machine, a place with billions of images continually proliferating, we thought about how this work might be an important experience for people to have, not only in terms of the obvious, in light of the world's focus on what is happening with the climate, but given what the sun is to the existence of the universe, an experience of something revealed that would inspire a wide range of thinking about cosmology, being, representation, the appearance of images in the world, night and day, time, life and death. We wanted to do something we think artists have always done, open up the curtain on something you don't normally get to see, that this might be a necessary image or a vital experience. It is quite humbling to open a tear in the firmament and look into the heart of this nuclear life force. And we hope that there is kind of something extra that is transmitted from the work, hence its formalism and its aesthetic approach, that occurs consciously and otherwise, not in a traditional spiritual sense, but more in the sense of the monad, a singular entity, the life force. So,
I just wanted to show you very briefly the latest work that we worked on at the end of last year, which is called Telepathy, which is almost the antithesis of Earth Star. Telepathy is a
sculptural anechoic chamber.
Sorry. It's a sculptural anechoic chamber. Sorry. And we're using a kind of transmission. Once you go inside it, this is a what do you call it?
It's a panorama shot
image
of
that's being splayed out. Yeah. And it's full of maybe a ton of sound absorbing and frequency absorbing rubber, so that you have this completely experience of a frequency less. So if Earth Star is a work that's concerned with frequency and resonance, this work is concerned with the complete absence of frequencies and resonance. And it's a pays to some degree a homage to modernism and some of the modernist tropes. Cage's famous experience in the anechoic chamber. And the image of it on the outside is obviously sculptural.
Here's just a quick time VR zoom around what it was like to go inside. I mean, you know, if a lot of these works have been energy gatherers, it was interesting to sort of try to just invert all the principles that we'd been working with to push it away, push the sound away.
Sorry.
You know, many of us have heard that Cage story, and you know, it seems like it was interesting as artists to try to build one of these things. People certainly had an interesting personal experience with this work. Obviously, once sound disappears, there is this real feeling of, a disorientation and a loss of balance, I suppose. Basically, how it works is it converts sound waves into heat, which is absorbed by the foam. And so it's a kind of heat generator. It's like being inside a science fiction. It's like being inside a spaceship, I suppose. And it was very interesting to also create a work which was all about what the viewer experienced in the work, which is ultimately out of our control. And we might just leave it there.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Maybe you can just join us if there are any final questions, Joyce and David. What I was very interested in was that there is a kind of Gaia-like spirit. Come on. A Gaia-like spirit that connects the viewer, the feeler, the smeller with the elements. So this is something which is not going through abstraction. It's going through re-enhancement of very, very complex phenomena, but in a way that is not reduced to language, to data, or what else. So is this kind of even the challenge that we have, whilst you will try to describe it in terms of ekphrasis? We have had this discussion yesterday, like you describing a picture, it's quite easy. But even something that you hear can easily describe it. But what about smell? What about touch? What about these elements that you are reconstructing?
Michelle Serres says that philosophy has lost its nose and its mouth, its taste. And, I think that is a really interesting thing. And I think in his writing, he tries to kind of re-inscribe the senses very sensually. And, hopefully, I think that, that's something that the work can also live up to. It's just giving you the experience, perhaps.
One other aspect, maybe, which may sound a bit colonial or post-colonial, because you mentioned that they were out there in the outbacks and you have been in residency there. And is there anything that, from a Western perspective, that we start to criticize very heavily by just emphasizing what maybe other cultures are very interested in? And how far does this inflect onto this world? To say that, okay, you have been out there and there are different cultures, even we talked about this yesterday, you can't even take an image. So does it play a role in this work?
I think it certainly does. I think we did a little bit of work up in Arnhem Land with Indigenous communities, and the thing that we did a new media arts workshop up there, and we all arrived with all our equipment, and the first thing we realized that every piece of equipment we were carrying was an implement of capture, and that we could put them all away because we couldn't use any of them. And it sort of forced us to really think very seriously about how we were looking and what we were looking at and what, in a sense, what part of the landscape was a part already inscribed by the Indigenous community, and I guess how Westerners are such a colonizing, it's such a colonizing kind of culture. We just colonize and don't even think about it. And it has driven us into looking and listening in very different kinds of ways. Hence, we did, I think at that stage we were listening with the VLF, with the Indigenous people, and we also were, did a whole lot of balloon cam, which we were dragging cameras around, pointing it at the ground, so that we wouldn't pick up any kinds of landscape. But I think it also did take us into looking through various kind of resonating devices, rather than attempting to take away the image.
Yeah, I mean, in that context, actually, the old fellas who were advising us about what was actually going on for them, and we were in their territory, so we were working with their law, did say to us that I asked if it was okay to photograph the stars, and they went away for a couple of hours and came back and said, you know, the stars are for everyone, and it's okay. But whatever you do, don't photograph that rock over there and stay away from that tree. And I think that that was quite life-changing in a sense, because obviously we're coming from a fairly traditional contemporary art position in terms of formalism and how our work's put together. And it sort of did highlight to me that, in a weird sort of way, if there's a crisis in contemporary art, it's the fact that it is kind of undifferentiated and completely open. It's sort of almost anything goes terrain, and here we were with a 30,000-year-old culture where actually images are inscribed and made under law for lots of reasons. I mean, reasons which are literally taken as life-threatening. And I think that that difference is very instructive for any artist to actually then start to, it's a new critical paradigm. It's not one that's come through art theory, but one that's come through something else, the most mentally driven culture that we've ever encountered, I think. But yeah, it's a big topic, that one.
Thank you for giving us some insight on how the piece came together, not only what we see in the gallery and how the outback was the background. We can open up it for one or two questions, otherwise we are quite late, but still, if you have a question that you want to ask to either David, Joyce or Steve, that would be the opportunity. There are still opportunities in the break afterwards, of course, but if you have any urgent questions, please ask that now.
Oops, hello, hi, and maybe it's not really a question, but more of a statement. I think one of the things which I find really interesting in both of the projects, and of course they're difficult projects to compare because they're using quite different kinds of strategies, is this emphasis on a positive take of the world and the universe and the atmosphere, both in Steve's work and in Joyce and David's work. And I really appreciate that, because especially this aspect of, let's say, the negativity of activism, and also a lot of the, let's say, the darker sides of art dealing with the spectrum and so on, I think are really quite nicely turned upside down in these works. And what you mentioned, Steve, in passing, that I don't know if I can paraphrase it now exactly anymore, but that we're maybe tired of the digital, or what was that?
The novelty had worn off.
Right, that the novelty of the digital has worn off. And I think this part of this problem is the negativity. And when we're going to work on better forms of interaction and intervention, which is such an important part of our art, or of your art and also of the others, we have to emphasize this positive and yes aspect and not just the no.
One of the things that Larry, the clown, said was, it's a two-handed strategy. You destroy with one and you build with the other. And so, you know, like, if you're just talking about how great the world is, that's not going to be helpful either. But to only speak about the negative things just wears people out and turns you bitter. And that's why activists quit, you know? It's like, get burned out. And so to be able to do both and do it well, that's the art.
Yeah, but that's what keeps people on their toes.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, let's just keep on going, calling this dialectics. And with this very old-fashioned conclusion, let's conclude this panel because we are late.
Okay.
And please attend the next one. And thank all artists. And again, congratulations on behalf of the jury. Thanks for attending.